third one for 2018. I'd like to welcome everybody here. And first on the agenda, I guess we have a new swearing in. Ken Jones from Summit County, correct?
Yes, sir.
Welcome aboard.
Thank you.
I don't know if I should congratulate you or apologize to you. Probably apology would probably be more in order, so. But yeah, welcome aboard. If Kathy will come up, she can swear you in.
Okay. So repeat after me. I, Richard K. Jones.
I, Richard K. Jones.
Having been appointed to the office.
Having been appointed to the office.
Of Bail Bond Surety Oversight Board Member.
Of Bail Bond Surety Oversight
Board Member. Do solemnly swear and affirm.
Do solemnly swear and affirm.
That I will support.
That I will support.
Obey and defend.
Obey and defend.
The Constitution of the United States.
The Constitution of the United States.
And the Constitution of the State of Utah.
And the Constitution of the State of Utah.
And that I will discharge the duties of my office with fidelity.
I will discharge the duties of my office with fidelity.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so if you want to sign there. Up here.
You're in now. You can't turn back. So. Next, we'd like to recognize your predecessor, Katie Booth, for her efforts here on the board, and we have a plaque for her. I'm not sure if Commissioner may have a word for her.
I'm glad Steve has the plaque. So Katie's not here, but we do want to express appreciation for her contributions and service to the board. So there's a nice plaque. We understand, Kim, that you're a neighbor.
I am.
And she asked us if we would give it to you, and if you would give it to her. So, thank
honored
you.
To accept it on her behalf.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I'll shake your hand, and you can shake hers and say, thank you for your service to the board, to each of you. I know it's a thankless job, and we appreciate your work and energy and efforts.
I'll let her know.
Get a chance to review or adopt our minutes. We would like a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Second.
I have an issue with the.
Why, I thought you said motion.
On the front page, third bullet point, it says they're finalizing the automated probable cause system. Hopefully, it will be done before the pretrial risk assessment tool. It will law enforcement submit their, it doesn't make sense. That just needs clarification.
Gotcha.
I think everybody understands the intent, but we need to make sure it's clear.
Of course.
Thanks, Kurt, for pointing that out. Now, outside of that one change, is there any others anybody would like to bring up? Get a motion to pass. To do that.
I'll move to approve this as amended.
All in favor?
Aye.
Pass.
So we had Kurt. You did the. Kurt did the motion, correct? Who did the second?
Second.
Dominic, second. Awesome. Thanks.
No need for an executive session, am I right?
We need to discuss the revocation privately or no?
We have it up for, normally speaking, we discuss it in the open.
Okay.
And then if there are causes or concerns that move it to an executive, then
okay.
That's the route we would take.
Okay. Then we'll move on to licensing report. How about that, Kathy?
All right. So the licensing report is for April, May, and June. And I want to, as far as the agencies themselves go, there was a little activity because the major part of the activity that actually occurs starts in July, because we have our renewal date of July 15th, where I need all the supporting documentation regarding how you're actually backed. If you're backed collaterally, if you're backed surety, or if you're backed by a letter of credit. And with the surety, you know, it's just a qualifying power of attorney, but if you're talking about the collaterally backed, you know, we default back to 31A35404 right at the present time, where it has the information that we need in order to renew your license, meaning your CPA statement, your liquidity. You know, the code states $100,000 liquidity. Your CPA prepares a form for you, and it's based on the information that you supply. And generally speaking, you're supplying those documents to your CPA for them to write the report. Most of the time when the CPA sends me the information, they're sending me the report without the backing or the documentation. I've been asking on the liquidity part just to verify that, to make sure that we've got the $100,000. Or if you're actually backed totally by liquidity as opposed to equity, that, you know, you provide whatever portion of the liquidity that is backing your collaterally based agency.
Just so I understand you correctly, Kathy, what you're looking for is a little more proof on the liquidity end versus just the say of a CPA saying yes, that's the requirement.
Yes, and this is just to make sure that you know, everything is in order.
So some documentation to back that up.
Yes, absolutely. So it's not that we've changed anything, because it does talk about liquidity. Mm-hmm. You've already provided that at least to your CPA. We're just asking for that information to make sure that our records reflect what is correct.
Now, is that something that in the process of a renewal, if you identify that they haven't got that documentation, you contact the surety to provide that for you?
The collaterally backed agency. Yeah, I do contact them. The requirement is that, you know, you're providing your CPA and it lists all that. So
right. It's
just an additional piece of documentation. If you provide everything that you're required to by July 15th, and that piece is in there, I'll be calling you to get that just to verify it. But it's not that you have not provided what you're supposed to
right. By
July 15th. It's just additional information.
Okay, great.
Okay, so when we're talking about the agency activity, I do want to say this has been at least the last 3 months as far as agents themselves go. It's so good. I mean, there have only been a couple. A couple of people have just got back one person got back into the business. They were gone almost a year. So they're back into the business. So, and another person just didn't write anything during the time frame, that type of thing. So that happens quite a bit. Are there any questions about?
No. Not that I have, unless anybody else has any. Move on to a summary of enforcement reports.
Right. Okay.
Our favorite part.
It is. Regarding the audits, there has been one complete. I am in the process of them. They're always a work in progress and in process. And it's, if you don't hear from me when I'm in the middle of an audit for a little bit, it's not because anything's wrong. You're always welcome to give me a call. We are continuing the audit process.
So
if we're looking at the investigation part of it, if you look, there were 25 cases that were opened in the last 90 days, and most of them dealt with designation issues. And again, when we're talking about designation issues, the agent themselves gets an email 75 days before. Once their license lapses, they're notified by email, but the agency is also notified by email. And so that shouldn't happen very much, okay? And then there were a couple others with failure to pay judgment, but generally speaking, it was designation issues. To the enforcement cases, those are the cases that are currently over to the Attorney General's office. And again, once they leave us, the attorneys are working generally attorneys on the other side, and the process is adjusted because of whatever is happening between the attorneys before it actually gets to.
And do we know how many cases are over there?
Well, right at the present time, we still just have, at least with our Dell, I believe it's three.
Three?
Yeah. Well, actually, let's see. It's actually two because we did close one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So one was resolved.
All right, then. If that's all of them, I guess we can move on to new business. We have a new application, and I would say they were crazy for wanting to get in this industry, but I happen to know this person is well known in the industry, and he's even crazier for trying to get back into it.
Amen.
I know he's crazier for other reasons besides that, too. But.
Okay. So the application that we're looking at right now is for 007 bonds. And I'd just like to go through some of the information for you. The Articles of Organization of 007 Bonds, so it's a DBA under Todd Harris, and so that's not needed. The EIN for 007 Bonds has been reported, and under our code, the EIN can be for trust accounts and what have you, can be the federal identification number, or it can actually be a social security number. The Department of Commerce has issued a certificate of existence for 007 bonds, and that was issued May 18, 2005, and they are currently in good standing. 15, thank you, 15. I saw the five and just missed the one. The liquidity, we do have a bank statement from the bank account showing that there is over $100,000 in a bank account. Certified public accountant reviewed the statement. We did receive that, and so all the information was reviewed on that regarding the liquidity and also the equity that we'll be talking about in just a minute. We did receive the 2017 federal tax return, and the 2016 federal tax return were also provided. We received preliminary title reports because two pieces of property are being used to help get to the $300,000. So one of them, so between the liquidity of the bank, which was over $107,000, and the equity in the two pieces of property, the minimum of the $300,000 has been met. There is an operational account for 007 bonds. At this particular point in time, 007 is electing not to take cash collateral or use a trust account. So that part has not, they don't have to have a trust account if they're not going to take cash collateral. They did report on their application that there was a 2016 administrative action, and they provided the information regarding it, and so that has been reported as required. The 2,000 hours, Todd Harris is the designated licensed person, and he's also 007 bail bonds. He's been licensed as a bail bond agent since July 31st, 1998. He did own breakout bail bonds from May 12, 2010 through August 14, 2016. He's been associated to various agencies since 1998. And he did provide a letter regarding the hours that he spent.
Alright, well, I guess the next thing to do is to vote on it.
We've got a couple of questions.
Yes.
Go ahead. You say there's two pieces of property. What names are the properties under?
Okay. The names of the property, hold on just a second.
Okay.
one property is under Todd Harris. And correct me if I'm wrong, Todd.
Excuse me?
The appraisal for one of the properties is under Todd Harris.
One of the houses is my own private residence. The other is a vacant piece of property.
Mm-hmm.
All properties are in the name of Todd Harris, 007 Bonds. So they're titled as 007 Bonds, Todd Harris.
Anybody have any other questions about 007's application? Go ahead, Gary.
I want to question the hours of this experience. I would certainly accept those. But I think that the Oversight Board and the Commissioner needs to review 31A23A107 character requirement, 31A23A402 unfair marketing, and 31A23110 form and content of sublicense. There are several issues. The license that Todd Harris owns, well, first of all, Todd Harris is something of a nickname. His legal name is Dennis Todd Harris. He holds a license with the Department of Insurance under the Todd Harris. All 07 Bonds is a DBA of the Todd Harris. The conveyances on the property was not to the Todd Harris, but was to Todd Harris. Now, I have to assume that the Todd Harris and the Todd Harris is one and the same, but it is an incorrect convey of title. It needs to be corrected if you're going to consider those properties, that it should be done under the Todd Harris, doing business as 007. In 2016, Todd Harris, as an individual, and Breakout Bail Bonds surrendered the Breakout Bail Bonds license in lieu of administrative action. In that administrative action, it was found that he was violating the rules of a trust account. Now, I find it interesting that he's not going to do a trust account, but under the earlier allegation, he was using Breakout Bail Recovery as the holder of the collateral and not using the actual bail bond entity to hold his collateral. When that license was surrendered, the department viewed Todd Harris as the entity that was surrendering the license, but they just used the agency license, not the individual license, which I still don't quite understand. There was a $10,500 fine assessed, and that's why the license was, I believe, was surrendered in lieu of paying that $10,500. Going to other matters, I don't know that if Mr. Harris listed that he is a defendant currently in a lawsuit going on, which I've got the case number, and doing research, I couldn't find that there was ever a satisfaction of a judgment filed from a lawsuit that he was, judgment was ordered against him back for, in approximately about 2010, for $11,245. Now, if that's been satisfied, I think the satisfaction needs to be presented to this board before you can consider that application. I'm through. Thank you.
May I speak to that?
Certainly.
There is no judgment.
Can you tell us
my name is Edward Wells. I'm Mr. Harris's attorney. There is no judgment. The case is still pending. There is currently a motion to set aside the prior rulings because the original premise of the case that he had illegally foreclosed was based upon an erroneous ruling by a court reinstating a bond which has since been
vacated, nunc pro tunc, and so the whole basis for that lawsuit went out the window. We're in the process of having it dismissed. There is no judgment, and Mr. Walton well knows, since he appeared as an expert for the defense, that there is no legitimate legal basis for that lawsuit.
I certainly highly disagree with that, and I could not see anything in the court docket where that order had been overturned. But I do know that that is under some appeal. But then there's also the matter of the current judgment of Bankers Insurance against Todd Harris and Breakout Bail Bonds. And I believe you're representing counsel on that also.
Actually, I'm not a defender of Bankers Insurance. Bankers Insurance is a defendant in a case where we are suing over what Harris is talking about.
I'd like to clarify that. They have filed, through their attorneys, a countersuit against Mr. Harris and from the what they felt was the frivolous action against Bankers Insurance. That's a local Salt Lake firm. And I believe Mr. Wells is the one that's going to be answering that complaint.
Well, and a counterclaim is just that. It's a claim. In my opinion, there's no basis for it, but be that as it may, there is no judgment, there is nothing else. It's a matter completely apart from the bail bond business. It has to do with a legal malpractice claim. So it's nothing to do with a bail bond.
Does anybody have any more to add to this subject?
If you'd like to read, I have here a letter from the Davis County Attorney's Office for your review, who is in the process of possibly filing criminal charges against the parties involved in this civil suit that Gary's making reference to. You're happy to read that and put that on the open record for a felony attempt to extort from me. And that's the case that Gary's referring to, where I supposedly have been fined. The facts of the matter was that, very simply put, we bailed the defendant out of jail. He failed to appear in court. I had him in handcuffs. I felt sorry for him. I let him off the handcuffs. I let him get back into court. He got back into court a month after the failure to appear notice. The judge reinstated my bond. Now, there's not a bondsman here that doesn't realize exactly what the judge did wrong. She had virtually no authority whatsoever to reinstate my bond. The defendant failed to pay his bond fees. I attempted to collect. They, in turn, attempted to turn it into a class action lawsuit. I have since had the bond exoneration overturned nunc pro tunc by Judge Skanke. It's on the record. Therefore, I was perfectly, legitimately, and legally right in taking action against the defendant for the payment of the bond fees. They chose to escalate it completely out of control because of judicial error. There were three judicial errors in this, which I can prove. I didn't come here prepared to deal with the civil case. I came here prepared to deal with my license. But since it's been brought up, this whole case has been completely overturned. I have the evidence to support it. And there's the documentation right there. It's even gotten to the extent that the county attorney is involved for possibly criminal charges against those parties that have been persecuting and prosecuting me in this manner.
Well, thanks, Todd, for a little bit of a clarification, and thanks, Gary, for bringing up some possible issues to light. I'm still going to try and hold a vote here on it, so all in favor of approving 007 bonds for approval on of their license, say aye. All opposed?
Nay.
Nay.
Looks like we're split.
Yeah, I'd like to abstain for this one.
I think we need some more clarification.
All right, then in that case, Todd, do you understand what clarification some folks are looking for?
What do you want?
Dominic?
That's dated 2015, October. Oh, I don't see what relevance it has.
He's rendering his license after.
The case is still pending.
Okay. And criminal charges haven't been brought in 3 years? I mean, I'm just asking questions.
Give you a little bit of legal history. I entered an appearance in the case about 5 months ago because it was languishing. The plaintiffs have not pushed forward with anything since he obtained the non-pro-tunk judgment. I think they're hoping it'll just die and go away. I'm in the process of preparing documents to get the whole case dismissed. But we may need to take a deposition before that happens, and we've been holding off to make that determination. But there is nothing has moved on the case now for about 3 years, and it's the plaintiff's obligation to move the case, and they're not doing anything. So we haven't spent the time and the effort yet. I've been involved with some other things with Mr. Harris, but that's on the burner. It's going to happen. There is nothing in there at this point in time that would serve as a basis for denying a license.
Gary?
At the very least, I think that those quitclaim deeds need to be clarified or corrected to show the actual name of the operating entity, which is D. Todd Harris, and not Todd Harris. Todd Harris, he changes his name like people do socks. It's Todd Harris, it's D. Todd Harris, or it's Dennis Todd Harris, depending on who he's dealing with. And I think that there's some clarification. I know that one of my agents was fined substantially for not changing her married name to her current married name, and was doing business under her former married name. And I would think that if there's no alias filed with the Department of Insurance for all three of these names, I think that that needs to be filed, and I think that needs to be clarified, and certainly those quitclaim deeds need to be resolved.
Kathy?
A couple items. Gary, could you explain which character requirement you were referring to under 107?
The fact that he surrendered his license in lieu of is one of them. The other is the fact that this name changing back and forth, and I've got documents that will show the use of all three names if the board is interested.
I'd like to recommend that some of the concerns that have been brought up, we need to look at a little further. So what I'd like to recommend is that we gather a little bit more information, and that with Todd Harris, and then approach the board in a teleconference.
Exactly. I would think it was unfair. If you can provide the information needed, it'd be unfair to make him wait 3 months to get into business. So
correct.
If you can get the things that's being asked as far as clarification on a few issues, the sooner you can get them together, the sooner we'll get together and make a vote. Do you understand?
The biggest thing that we probably need is the non-pro-tunk order, where the judge exonerated my bond and the defendant walked back.
I think there's two people here that you need to satisfy, so you might want to confer with them on exactly what they need in order to get an approval. But
yeah,
so. All right, well, moving on then. We have a guest speaker. I think we'll all be excited to hear from. Hopefully he's got some good news for us. Jeff Clayton's with ABC. That's a national bail bonding entity that pretty much is the authority on what we're dealing with here. So hopefully Jeff can give us some insight on what's going on nationally in the pretrial bail bond world.
Well, thanks. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Jeff Clayton. I'm the executive director of the American Bail Coalition. Coalition. The American Bail Coalition is a trade association of insurance companies that underwrite criminal bail bonds in all the states where we're allowed to do that, which is, I believe, 46. I had a really fancy PowerPoint presentation, but we had an issue with the projector, so I'm just going to speak from the slides, but trust me, it's really slick. It's amazing. The title of my presentation.
We could ask you to do is just provide that to Steve, and Steve will put it on the website, website, and then people
Absolutely.
Can view it and have it.
Just going to kind of give you an update. The title today is Trends in Bail Reform. I'm going to break it into a couple of different areas. And just so you know what I do, I mean, I travel the country working on bail reform issues. So if there's a headline about bail reform, I'm probably either somehow involved in it or know somebody that's involved in it. And that goes for pretty much every state across the country. I have been to 31 state capitals since I took this job in 2015, so I've been a busy guy. Part of the request was that I update on Colorado, which I will do, but in the sort of spirit of full disclosure, I'm not there very often anymore, even though I live there. So just to give you an idea of how I broke this up, I'm going to talk about some of the legal cases that are out there challenging the right to bail, challenging bail schedules. There's a couple cases challenging reforms that have happened in a couple of states that I'll talk about. I'm going to run through quickly all the states where we saw action on bail reform in this sort of season of state legislative sessions, which for those of you who don't know, in other states, it's very similar to Utah, where a lot of the legislatures meet in the spring, and then they're done by this time of year. So there's only a few left. California has 51 days left. They're on break for 30 days. Michigan never goes out of session, so it could do anything at any time. That's the same with New Jersey. But for the most part, they're all done. The story for 2018 has pretty much been told. Going to talk about risk assessments. As we know, with the Arnold Foundation here, that discussion is rapidly changing. And so I'll talk a little bit about that. And then I'll talk about a couple of regulatory issues that we've seen in a couple of different states, at the Department of Insurance level. So let me start with the legal cases. Since 2015, really led on by former Attorney General Eric Holder, there have been challenges to bail, the legality of bail, the constitutionality of bail. It started with challenges to bail schedules, and the argument was it discriminates based on wealth for this period of time in between when the schedule operates and they see a judge, and that's unconstitutional. And that was really kind of the first case in Georgia where things started. This movement, as you guys know, has exploded. And right now, the American Bail Coalition, along with other partners, we are literally fighting for the meaning of the Eighth Amendment. What does the Eighth Amendment mean? Does it allow bail? Does it not allow bail? Does it allow schedules? Does it not allow schedules? So a couple of cases going, we have O'Donnell versus Harris County, Texas, where Harris County's Houston. Harris County's master bond schedule was challenged by activist lawyers on behalf of some plaintiffs, filed a class action. The Harris County bail system was found unconstitutional, and we probably, at the time, thought it was going to happen. And the reason the Harris County bail system was found unconstitutional was because in Texas, they have a procedure where they call it magistrating someone. But really, it's sort of like listening to your own fate or watching your own fate on TV, because you can't see. And so the county thought that was adequate due process from the schedule, and the judge said it wasn't, and we thought it wasn't either. So we sort of knew that was a problem. The case went up to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, which is one level below the U.S. Supreme Court. The Fifth Circuit overturned the judge's order and held that a bond schedule is constitutional. Harris County's due process was unconstitutional. In other words, you didn't get a meaningful review hearing of your bail set by a schedule within 48 hours in Harris County. There's still some fight over the injunction, but on the whole, it was a victory in the sense that the Court of Appeals is holding that a bond schedule is not only constitutional, but it helps facilitate people out of jail. So you'll read in the papers that it was a major landmark decision, but really the only landmark decision was it was unconstitutional, but only for a short period of time. And to the extent the judges are now going to go through a process of having an affidavit when somebody says they're poor and they're going to have to consider this within 48 hours, they can still have a master bond schedule. Walker versus Calhoun, Georgia is another case where the activist lawyers got lucky. and a judge held that a bond schedule is unconstitutional because it discriminates based on wealth. This case has gone up to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit twice. We're on round two now. I was at the oral argument, I can't even remember what it was, last month or ish. And I think there, I think the 11th Circuit is gonna overturn the judge's order and hold that bond schedules are constitutional, very similar to the 5th Circuit, that you can't have this instantaneous unconstitutional system when you have a bond set by a schedule and then it's all of a sudden instantaneously unconstitutional. That just can't be the law. And the judges on the panel were pretty sympathetic to our argument. Representing the American Bail Coalition is a guy by the name of Paul Clement, who was a Solicitor General under the second George Bush. Really smart guy, handled the Obamacare case. I mean, is, you know, one of the top lawyers around. And the judges were definitely receptive to his argument. His argument was essentially, look, if you rule an instantaneous right to affordable bail, you've just declared the entire federal scheme unconstitutional. Do you guys really want to go there? And the answer is no. Because under the federal system, they can say, we don't want to do your bail today, we want a 5-day extension, and it's automatic. And so there's no hearing in the federal system for up to 5 days. And the judges were like, oh, we don't want to go there. Another pending case, we've got two out in the Ninth Circuit. Ninth Circuit is, you know, sort of Washington, California, et cetera. In one case, a federal district judge ruled that there is no right to an affordable bail, that discrimination is based on wealth. It's not a protected class. In other words, whether you're wealthy or not is something that the Constitution protects. Another judge has denied that argument and gone a different direction, and that case is called Buffett versus the City of San Francisco. These lawyers are going to go to trial. The trial is set for the third week in September in Oakland at the federal courthouse. The lawyers on the other side originally were sort of these upstart activists. Now, the firm that Eric Holder belongs to has gotten involved, and so they're trying the case. I've reviewed some of the data, and I can't really get into it, largely because of the attorney-client privilege. But let's just put it this way. We kick ass. I mean, we, the bail industry, we kick ass in San Francisco. We do so much better than any other form of release. The numbers that are being analyzed by the experts are finally coming out. So I'm confident that I think we're going to prevail, and I don't think that the California bail system is unconstitutional. Obviously, they have high bails, but it's the cheapest place to get bail because you can charge as low as zero for bail in California. So, because you could rebate the entire premium if you wanted to. So you could bail somebody out on a $300,000 bond for zero if you chose to. And so that's the reason why you've got these humongous bonds, because it's a race to the bottom on the premium side. Holland versus Rosen is an affirmative case where Lexington National Insurance Corporation and a guy by the name of Britton Holland sued the state of New Jersey, arguing that their system denies the right to bail, and the right to bail must include consideration of monetary conditions of bail. Britton Holland got in a bar fight after an Eagles game. He's a Cowboys fan in New Jersey. Had a little duke out, and he was denied bail under New Jersey's new system. The prosecutor was going to file a motion for preventative detention against Holland. Holland didn't obviously stay in jail the whole time, so he agreed to be on essentially house arrest and pretrial supervision, which he argued was more restrictive than bail. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit on Monday ruled that there is no constitutional right to a monetary or cash bail. However, it's my understanding Lexington's going to appeal that to the U.S. Supreme Court. And what, interestingly in the case, what they found is there is a constitutional right to a personal surety who can post cash for you. And so I don't know how they're going to reconcile that. I mean, because obviously in 1912, the U.S. Supreme Court said that the distinction between a personal surety and bail is mundium, which is a term meaning ancient French law that has no meaning. And so I don't know how they're going to square that, because the personal surety system is our system. And Justice Holmes, in that opinion, and then interpretations of that opinion, basically explain why. And the why is because when people started moving west, the personal surety system relied on having friends. And people didn't have friends because they just moved here. And so that's how the bail bond business actually grew up. And what the U.S. Supreme Court said eliminated this distinction between personal sureties. So, we're hoping that the U.S. Supreme Court will find that you have to consider bail. And you do under the federal system, even though the judges don't bite very often. They still have to consider it. Second one is Rogers versus Christie. That would be Governor Chris Christie. The June Rogers case, I'm not sure many of you are familiar with in New Jersey, but some of you may be. Christian Rogers was a guy who was gunned down by a guy who got out on the Arnold Foundation tool. He was a prior felon in possession of a firearm. The tool counted him low risk, so they OR'd him. And he, the next day, surprisingly, found another gun somewhere. I'm not sure where he got that. And unloaded 22 rounds into Christian Rogers. And so the family, the estate, is suing the governor and the Arnold Foundation for basically products liability. I'm not sure it has any legs, but it does point out a serious flaw in the Arnold tool, which we've seen in Iowa. In every place we've seen it is prior felons in possession of firearms. Like, how can they be low risk? Like, I just, you know, in San Francisco, prior felon in possession of a machine gun was low risk. And I'm asking myself, that doesn't, how can that pass the common sense test? But that's certainly what we've seen.
We had one this past week, prior felon, possession of firearm.
Yep, all day long. To the point where the New Jersey Attorney General had to come out and say, we're changing the tool because it's counting too many of these guys low risk. And we know that the results of the tool don't make sense generally. They don't generally pass the common sense test. Second case, and I'll talk a little bit more about this. This is an older case, but it's called State v. Loomis. It's worth bringing up. Because what it says is there's a due process right when you want to challenge an algorithm, the results of an algorithm. And there has to be warnings. And those warnings, unfortunately, are not part of any of the deployment of these pretrial tools. And I think that makes them vulnerable to attack on due process grounds. The U.S. Supreme Court denied cert, but basically the Wisconsin Supreme Court had a list of warnings that had to be given to the judges when these tools came out, saying this is not scientific, this is not, you know, this is how it works, it's not the end-all be-all, all this sort of thing. All these basic warnings that aren't part of Utah's or any of the other parts of the system. Legally, I think we're going to prevail on these cases. I think the right to bail is fundamental. I think having a bond schedule has been well-settled law since the 70s. It facilitates release. I think at the end of the day, what we found out is in a lot of places in the South, there's really bad due process. You talk about Maurice Walker. Here's a guy who was arrested for public intoxication. The bond schedule said $160, and because it was a small town, they only had court once a week. It was a holiday. So it took him 13 days to get in front of a judge. And that's a problem. But that's a due process problem more than it's a bail problem. And that's really what we have said nationally is, look, just get him in front of court if you're going to have a bail schedule, and then I'll take care of this problem. Talking about from the state capitals and the trends that we're seeing, the other side, the people trying to eliminate not only bail bondsmen, but any type of financial security as part of your release, call themselves right now the third generation of bail reform in America. And that really, they should call themselves the second generation of bail reform in America, because that's essentially all they've done, is take the second generation of bail reform in America and move it into the third generation, but it's the same stuff. And really what it is implementing the Federal Bail Reform Act of 1984. That's what they want. They want a system of you're in or you're out, and there's nothing in between. I call it the bipolar system, because it is bipolar, and plus it just paints it in a bad light. But that's really what it is. And I can tell you the trend is against. The movement has shifted. And I'll explain in a couple of minutes, you know, why that's happening. But let's just go kind of west to east to some states and kind of talk about what's happened. In Alaska, I think, is a good example of a rollback of bail reform because of several incidents where people were getting out. A senator actually ran a bill and passed it to undo bail reform that had passed the previous year because nobody was showing up for court. And there were massive crimes while out on bail under this OR program that they were running. Hawaii rejected bail reform this year. It was a significant move to that largely would have eliminated bail in Hawaii. It was rejected by the legislature. California has been a major fight for several years. Last year, I made 21 trips to Sacramento. This year, I made one trip to Sacramento because everything's quiet. Nothing is really happening in terms of Senate Bill 10, which is the major bill against us. That would largely eliminate bail in California. A companion bill, Assembly Bill 42, was run in California last year, which we killed in the last week of the session by 5 votes, which in California is difficult to do because in the Assembly there's 80 members, there's 55 Democrats, and we won by 5 votes. So you can sort of see that, you know, you have to make a more bipartisan argument when you're out in California. You don't talk about public safety as much as you talk about trampling of defendants' rights by e-carceration, which is basically GPS, all these ankle monitors, all this type of stuff, that that's worse for defendants than bail. And that's been our argument primarily in a lot of these liberal jurisdictions where people don't really think about or care, seem to care about public safety, like California. There's a bill, Senate Bill 898, which y'all love this, to compare the bail industry to auto insurance, which doesn't really make any sense, but the senator was trying to get headlines and basically arguing that because we don't pay losses that we're some illegitimate form of insurance. Of course, we had the national people come in and say, that's the whole point of underwriting is to avoid losses. And if we don't have any, we've won, and that's what we're trying to do. That's why we have things like build-up funds and all this other business to stop that from happening. So that bill actually died a week ago Friday, so that was good.
One of the things you need to make sure of is make them understand that in regular, normal property casualty, losses are expected.
Right.
Bonding, theoretically, because you're able to recover that money, there's not supposed to be any losses.
That's right. That's right. And that's obviously when we had one of our executives bragging on the internet or something, I can't remember, that they hadn't paid a loss in 5 years, certainly that didn't help us. Because it didn't really tell the whole story, because those agents were paying. It's just it never dinged the insurance company. But the insurance companies have paid. I mean, one of our sureties paid a $3.2 million loss 5 or 6 years ago when some Hollywood guy who split. So it does happen. It's just
interesting.
He paid cash bail.
I guess Hillary posted his bill. Yeah. Idaho, major attack on us. Constitutional amendment was drafted and run to take out bail. To eliminate the right to bail in Idaho and implement the New Jersey system. We killed it, we throttled it pretty hard, it didn't really even go anywhere really. But it was a message to us that this could happen in any state. It's not politics driven, because law enforcement typically will take the bait that we can preventatively detain our way to success. And history has proven that doesn't work, largely because we can't get the right guys. We don't know who the right guys are. You know, we look at the Arnold Foundation tool, and if we take everybody that's a six and lock them all up like New Jersey does, what are we admitting to ourselves? We're locking up 55% of people in that category who are not going to fail to appear and not going to commit a new crime. So we're trampling on an extreme amount of liberty to get a very low, minimal result. The other thing is crimes while on bail are small percentage-wise because the time periods are so short. So the idea that there's all this crime going on and recidivism going on, it does happen. But during the bail period, it's pretty small. And so the idea that we, to get a 5% crime rate while on bail, we're going to lock up all these people, just doesn't make much sense. Obviously, the stuff that's been going on in Utah, you're all familiar with. The Arnold Foundation tool is in operation. When we were on the last phone call, Judge Shaughnessy basically told me that, well, we're going to leave the bond schedule in place, and it's just one more tool in the toolbox. And so obviously, we'll have to monitor to see what's happened. The Arnold Foundation tool has been implemented in places where it hasn't had an impact on bail, and largely it's because the judges just ignored the thing. And that happened in Lucas County, Ohio, where everybody talks about how successful the Arnold Foundation tool has been in Lucas County, Ohio, except, whoops, 2 months ago the court clerk administrator in an article said the judges have now begun to ignore it and go back to charge-based bail because it works better. So they're getting the report from the Arnold Foundation, they go, oh, that's nice, and they ignore it. Others have taken grant funding in jurisdictions that we've learned to get the grant funding, but then they don't use the tool and they ignore the tool. So they just get in the flow of revenue by appearing to be reformist when they're really not. So we'll have to monitor what's happening here. Obviously, we've seen an explosion, at least according to Wayne, in cash-only bails. And so we'll probably have to address that as an issue. In Colorado, the same thing is happening, even though the law says the defendant gets to choose unless the judge goes and makes a finding on the record. Well, guess what? They're not doing it. They're ignoring it, and the reason they're ignoring it, as you all know, is they get to keep it. And so cash bail judges like, because guess what? They get paid. If the guy doesn't show, they get paid. If the guy is guilty, they get paid. And they can take the whole corpus of the bail and distribute it out. And so we've seen that in other states. I mean, Indiana is probably the worst violator because they fund their entire court system on 10% bails. If they do 10% bail and there's a forfeiture, they get it. If it's a surety bond or 100% cash, it goes to the common school funds and first responder pensions, right? So they're doing it intentionally to get a flow of revenue. There's federal law on this point that makes it vulnerable to challenge when you use bail as a collections mechanism. And I haven't evaluated Utah, but I filed one of these cases in Colorado and won. And the judge and the DA admitted it. Yeah, I think this is an unconstitutional practice. And the judge had to give the the lady her money back, which I was setting up for a class action, but then I took this job, so I've been busy. New Mexico, let's go back to Colorado for a second. So legislation was run to get rid of bail and misdemeanors, which was killed. Colorado has split houses, so the Democrats control the House and the Republicans control the Senate. So the saying at the Colorado Capitol is it'll die on the other side, and that's pretty much what happened. It's really election dependent. If Democrats take over, I think they've already sent the signal that they're going to try to take us out again. The Crime Commission has met again, and despite the fact that they rejected preventative detention in 2012, they're recommending it again, and they're recommending a constitutional amendment. And I can tell you right now, it's not going to go anywhere. The defense bar in Colorado is really strong, the defense lawyers, and they hate preventative detention. And so it'd be really challenging to get the New Jersey system implemented in Colorado. That said, they are revalidating the assessment tool, which has not been revalidated since 2012, meaning that technically it's invalid right now, but let's not let that get in the way. They're revalidating the tool, and they're going to make a push next year to make the tool mandatory statewide. And the tool is, of all the tools I've seen, one of the worst. It uses demographic factors, which everybody pretty much agrees leads to race and gender discrimination, because those factors correlate with race. So it's one of the worst I've seen, and there's no money to do it in Colorado because of our tax structure. If it costs a nickel, it's going to die. And so I forecast we'll probably be okay. New Mexico's the biggest mess. I might as well call it Old Mexico, which is what I call it, because I would not go down there right now. Literally, I do not go to Albuquerque anymore. If somebody wants to meet in Albuquerque, I say, see you in Santa Fe, because it's an enclave. I'm not going to go to Albuquerque. I'm not going to rent a car. It's number one for car thefts. Other lines of insurance companies have told us they're considering drawing lines around Albuquerque and saying we're not going to insure your stuff, because guess what? People steal it. One of the agents called me one day and said, my assistant was looking out the storefront window and watched a guy in broad daylight walk up to her car, open it, and drive away. Last time I was in Albuquerque, I took a Uber car to Gerald Madrid, the bail bondsman's office, and the driver said, "Oh, you're going to a bail office." He goes, "Don't you know in New Mexico you can kill somebody and not have to post bail?" And I was like, unsolicited, you know. On the way back, the Uber driver said, "Oh, you're in a bail office. You know, in New Mexico you don't have to post bail, right? They got rid of that. So you can just do whatever you want." Okay. Of course, we've seen in the media amazing stories like the bait car that the police set up, and the two guys stealing it. They get pulled over, and the one guy says, one guy's all worried, "Oh, God, we're going to be in jail all week." And the other guy goes, "Buddy, we're going to be OR, man. We're going to be out of here. Piece of cake. We're out of here. Don't worry about it." That's on tape, and the criminals know. They know exactly what they're doing. I sat through an arraignment in Albuquerque about 6 months ago, and of all the people arrested on a felony in Albuquerque, which is Bernalillo County, guess how many people had to post bail to get out? Two people, motions for preventative detention, don't know what happened to them. The one person that had to post bail had convictions from 7 states, a federal conviction, and 32 prior failures to appear. But guess what the bond was? $2,500. The tool rules the day there, unlike it has here. The judges follow it exactly, because they've been threatened with discipline if they don't. And so if it recommends release on these conditions, that's what they do. And the prosecutors are powerless. They might as well not even be there, because the only time they stood up was to dismiss a case. They didn't disagree with anything, and the guy running the Arnold Foundation computer just sat there and recommended, and the judge went with it. Every single case but that one, where she said, "Well, it's 32 prior. Yeah, he's going to have to post $2,500. Really?" We tried to undo what was done. For those of you who don't know, I negotiated the constitutional amendment that passed, which was intended to create a hybrid system. And what I mean by that is, instead of having a bipolar system, be bail in between, right? So you could go to preventative detention, you can go to bail, if you don't want to do that, and then some of these people on the low end, we're just going to cut loose. That was how the system was supposed to work. Of course, Justice Charles Daniels, who I did the jig last night when I found out he's retiring, because he's one of my main nemesis in bail in this fight, screwed us over. He literally said before the amendment passed, "This gives me all I need to do, so I'll just implement this by court rule," which he did. And we were unable, and still have been unable to stop. And it's probably permanent, frankly. But I would tell you, don't schedule a vacation to go down there. It's just not safe. Texas, so you'll love this. This is so Texas. So Texas, so in Harris County, they're operating the Arnold Foundation toll, and it's had a fairly limited impact. The state of Texas, 2 years, so Texas meets every other year, the legislature. So this year they didn't meet. Last year, we got in a major fight because they ran a constitutional amendment, and they ran a bill to have mandatory statewide risk assessment, which we killed. And then the Chief Justice, because he lost, basically just decided to do an end run around us. So they're developing their own in-house tool that's very similar to the Arnold Foundation tool. They've hired a guy by the name of Matt. Why can't I think of his name? He is a forgettable guy. Matt, anyway, he came from the Arnold Foundation. He's working in Texas. The name of the new Texas risk assessment is so Bible Belt. It's the PRAISE TX system. And that will be debuted at any point, and we'll have to see what the impact of that's going to be. Texas code doesn't allow for the consideration of a risk assessment, and it has a list of exclusive factors. So we might have to spring in a lawsuit on them at some point, but that's basically what's going on down there. We're expecting more legislation as we go into next year. Iowa was a good result, although it wasn't as good as it could have been. As part of the budget, the Agents Association lobbyists slipped an amendment into the budget that said that the Arnold Foundation will be shut down at the end of the year. And the legislature changed that amendment to shut down immediately and passed it. To where if the governor would have signed the bill, the Arnold Foundation would have been shut down immediately. She was appointed as governor. She's politically nervous. So she line-item vetoed that and then issued an executive order saying we're shutting the Arnold Foundation tool down on December 31st. So we know what will happen is that the proprietors of the Arnold Foundation tool will come out and say all of a sudden it's awesome, it's great, it's tremendous, don't shut it down. But we're pretty sure the governor is going to shut it down and force the legislature to get involved, which is what we've always wanted, which is legislative oversight of this, rather than people just going into a room in a court somewhere and deciding, you know, this is how we're going to do bail. So that was a good result. Minnesota, there's an effort to regulate bounty hunters, and I'll talk about that in a second. There's many states where there's no regulation for bail recovery. My home state, one of them. We have tried for years to get regulation, and nobody wants to do it, B, admit there's a problem or do anything about it. When a guy got out of prison and was a recovery agent and got in a fight with a co-signer and the bail agent shot the co-signer, we thought something was gonna happen, but nothing has yet happened. Minnesota, same thing. They've got a guy who lost his license, but he's still allowable to do bail recovery, so he's doing bail recovery, and he does all kinds of crazy door kicking in and all this sort of thing, and the legislature has just about had enough. So unfortunately, the bill was killed, but I think we'll probably be running it again next year. Legislation in Missouri really didn't gain any legs, largely due to politics, but similar legislation that would have taken out bail, largely in misdemeanor cases. Same with Louisiana, bills on misdemeanor, cases and eliminating bail and misdemeanor cases didn't go anywhere either. Ohio was a major fight. Ohio was an attempt to do a statewide risk assessment. It was House Bill 439, and we were able to stop that. And Ohio has had a risk assessment since 2009. It was validated in 2009. It was passed by the legislature in 2011. As part of their system, they have 10 tools. 10 risk assessment tools, community reentry tool, prison intake tool, all these tools make decisions throughout the process. The problem is only 5 of the tools have ever been validated, and the other 5 haven't been revalidated since 2009, so that's a major problem that they have. The other thing is the data of the validation was so poor, it's hard to even call it valid. If you have risk categories 0 through 9 in Ohio, in categories 8 and 9, guess how many people were in the data set in categories 8 and 9 when they validated this in 2009? 2 in each category. And so we have making decisions about high-risk individuals and bail based on 4 people in 2009. I mean, I'm no data scientist, but that doesn't sound valid to me. So they've got major problems there, but we've been able to stymie that effort there. Michigan, there's been a lot of talk about doing a constitutional amendment, but as of right now, nothing has happened. West Virginia, there was also an attempt to take us out, essentially. There were 3 different bills, one dealing with misdemeanors, one dealing with presumptions against bail. I forget what the third one did, but it was a nasty package of bills that we were able to stop there. Maryland, the Court of Appeals, implemented their own rule to implement the New Jersey system, and they already had preventative detention. available, allowable. And so what has happened is what exactly what we told them would happen, which is if judges don't have bail, what are they going to do? They're going to lock them up, or they're going to, what I call, and what the guy who wrote the book on mass incarceration calls, e-carcerate, right? You're on house arrest or you're going to jail. So guess what happened in the first year after the Court of Appeals implemented their rule in Baltimore City? Anybody? The pretrial population increased 22%. 1 year. Disaster. Because judges have no options. They like using bail. They like having the option of bail. When they don't, they would do one of two things in high-risk cases. And that's what we saw. Delaware, there was a constitutional amendment run. We killed that. And that cannot be rerun until 2020. Joe Biden's daughter was involved in that and lobbying it. And so, you know, we had to make a little light of that because obviously when she was in college, she had a few drug charges for which bail was posted. So obviously that helped stir the pot, put the attention on the issue, and ultimately died. New York, major issue in New York. 100 community groups have gotten together and said, no algorithms in criminal justice. Don't even think about it, Governor Cuomo. If you do, we're going to arrest you alive. And so there was no conversation of risk assessment in New York. It's all, let's just get rid of misdemeanor bail, let's get rid of bail, let's not have bail. But that, because of the way New York politics works, the Senate is controlled by Democrats, but there's basically independent Democrats, and they control everything because they go on both sides of the aisle. So it hangs really on kind of two or three people getting elected in New York, and if they don't, you know, look out, there'll be bail reform again next year. In New York, what also has been hot is are these charitable bail funds. But we've finally gotten tax returns on those, and let's just say they're not sustainable. We could have told you that, right? Let's see, New Jersey, you know, we tried to undo it. New Jersey has stalled out. The state is not releasing any data. There's not one FTA number since January of 2017 when this was implemented. There's not one new crime law and bail number, which tells me the numbers are bad. A reporter and I from Philadelphia have been after these guys over and over asking for the data, and finally one of the clerks of court told this NPR reporter that we have the data, it's not good, so we have to put it in context before we can release it. In other words, they're going to go back in time and make the old system look worse than it was, so that when the new data comes out, it looks good. They're $14 million short of the budget this year, they're not going to get funded for that, and the pretrial program is going to run out of money completely by next year, and so they're on a collision course with reality, you might say, because they didn't fund it, the court fees were inadequate to fund it. And it's costing millions and millions of dollars. And the counties don't want to fund it because most counties there are at the cap of property taxes, so their only choice is to cut services to fund it, and they don't want to do that because they don't believe in it. Obviously, they sued the state and lost on a legal technicality 2 years ago, but that's beside the point. So New Jersey's kind of stalled out, but you know, there's some reason to think there's some light at the end of the tunnel. New Hampshire, good article today, from typical ACLU. Major progress made in New Hampshire, major progress. Well, the reality is we watered the bill down to the point where I really consider it a nullity because Class B misdemeanors in New Hampshire are non-jailable offenses for which judges were doing bail, and they just eliminated that practice. And my argument is if it's not a jailable offense, what the hell? I mean, what are you doing? If that's not an ultimate penalty, why is this person in jail unless it's contempt of court or something like that? Then I get it. So while the ACLU is proclaiming that, the reality is, you know, we watered it down. Same deal in Vermont. Big bill windowed down to low-level misdemeanor cases and having a presumption against bail. Georgia, there was a major effort as well, which we ended up making a deal on to where it's really low-level misdemeanors that judges are taking another look at. Florida was also a major fight. Largely, risk assessments was one bill, and then another bill to create more presumptions against bail, even though there's already presumptions against bail in Florida law. So to some of the key trends, I think, at the state level, we saw two constitutional amendments run and defeated. Risk assessments, as I said, were in every one of these fights except for New York. And so risk assessment has been a big topic. But I would say so far in 2018, no legislature has done any significant anything on bail reform so far. And like I said, there's 51 days till the California session ends, so fingers crossed on that. And I'll send you these slides, but I'm going to talk about what I'm calling algorithmic injustice, to talk about the break on what's happening on algorithms in criminal justice. If I came here 2 years ago and said, I think risk assessments might not be race and gender neutral, and I think they might not work. I would have been thrown out of the room, labeled a leper, and never invited back. Because you couldn't say that 2 years ago, because it was evidence-based practices, it was computers, it was science. To be against them would be against science 2 years ago. Now, I can walk all over the country and say, Robert Wirth, Rice University professor, last month issued a study, here, and I'll just read from it. While I focused here on assessment within parole, I suggest that risk techniques throughout legal and crime control arenas operate performatively and tend to reproduce their own logics. As already noted, a number of voices claim that risk and needs assessment can help mitigate or even end the era of mass incarceration. While sympathetic to the contention that risk represents a malleable logic that holds the potential to be deployed for multiple purposes, I would contend that risk assessment has, to this point, helped organize the penal state and fortify its legitimacy. He's literally arguing that labeling people as risky is the reason we have a cycle of criminality since 1970. And he gives examples in this article. How did the other side even argue with that? It's really difficult to argue with because it just hasn't worked. You look at any of these tools, they don't have an impact on mass incarceration. They're literally, in my view, all they're doing is shuffling deck chairs on a Titanic. When the ProPublica piece came out last year on the sentencing algorithm, it's called Compass. It's very similar to the Arnold tool. It's developed by the same people. ProPublica did a study and said, the Compass tool is racist. The Arnold Foundation has denied that their tool suffers from the same, they haven't denied that their tool suffers from the same problem. They have said that the problem that the Compass tool suffers from, they don't consider to be racist. So they don't have to do the analysis on their own tool. So they spent $700,000 to hire a research institution to do what's called the moderator regression approach on their tool. And so how does this work on these tools? Here's how this works. We're gonna predict amongst racial groups. So we're gonna take blacks and whites and we're gonna predict whether we can commit a new crime or fail to appear in court. The predictive parity approach that the Arnold Foundation and other tools use says that we just need to predict equally, right? We need to get it right the same number of times amongst groups, and that's good enough, right? So the Compass tool, guess how often it got it right? 62% of the time. Virtually identical between races. But what is the problem there? There's another theory of this, it's called error rate balance, okay? What happens when we get it wrong 38% of the time? Which direction do we get it wrong? Okay, and the ProPublica analysis found that 60 or 70% of the time when we got it wrong, when it came to African-American defendants, we labeled them more risky than they were. Whites got the benefit of being labeled less risky when we got it wrong, meaning that the consequences when we got it wrong were dire on racial grounds. The Arnold Foundation has denied, and their new vendor has denied, this is an appropriate way to analyze whether a tool suffers from race or gender bias. I disagree. Because to me, that is evidence that it's biased. And so that's really what the fight is over right now. The Arnold Foundation doesn't want to disclose this data. They don't want us to get a hold of it because my guess is it suffers from the same problem. These algorithms were all developed in a similar fashion. And so that's the reason I think we could probably make that conclusion. But they won't give us the data and they won't analyze it themselves, so we just don't know. We've seen validation issues, and as I told you, Ohio, they've revalidated their tool since 2009. Well, that's a problem because national best practices says you have to revalidate a tool every 12 to 24 months, and if you don't, it's invalid. And they're not doing it. Colorado, as I mentioned, hasn't been revalidated since 2012. So there's major issues that we've seen. Also, there's been calls by a group called the AI Now Institute at NYU to eliminate black box algorithms like the Arnold tool, where the public and the judges and the attorneys can't get behind the curtain and see how the thing was built and what assumptions were made. And so there have been legislative calls to eliminate that. There have been calls by professors to get rid of what's called trade secret privileges within a case. Great article that's been written about that by a Yale law professor, which basically says these people are putting themselves beyond reach because they give examples of where these trade secret protections have been asserted in cases to stop a person facing a life sentence from getting behind the algorithm that's recommending a life sentence. And I got a major problem with that. And so we are going to, we have submitted to the American Legislative Exchange Council a model policy on the regulation of algorithms to force transparency and to put some basic safeguards in place that you have to have validation, you have to have all this stuff, and you have to prove that these things are race and gender neutral before you can use them. And of course, the Arm Foundation doesn't want any piece of that because they like the idea that we sign a contract, we're good, we're over here, leave us alone. Another great article.
So, have you already approached ELEC on that then?
Yes, we've submitted the policy. The meeting is in New Orleans, August 8th through the 10th. And so I'll be presenting the Criminal Justice
Task Force. How about NCSL?
What's that?
How about NCSL?
No, we haven't. We have a good relationship with ELEC because our board chairman is.
Well, they're a great organization.
Yeah. Yep, is chair of the criminal justice.
And NCSL is larger,
sure,
more liberal, but
right,
larger. So it might be a good place to.
I think that's probably right. Just because our chairman is private sector chair of the Criminal Justice Task Force, it sort of helps our chances. So we chose to go there first, and we'll see what happens. Another good article that I think is worth reading is called Danger Ahead. It talks about the problems with pretrial risk assessments. And I'll just quote from this article. Pretrial risk assessment instruments, as they are currently used, cannot safely be assumed to advance performance goals of reducing incarceration and enhancing the bail system's fairness. Early evidence remains sparse, and risk assessment instruments may yet prove themselves effective tools in the arsenal of bail reform, but they have not done so today. Shifting to risk-based bail will not necessarily reduce incarceration. Without stronger data practices and open governance, we believe it is likelier than not that these tools will perpetuate or worsen the very problems reform advocates hope to solve. So the pivot on this has gone 180 degrees in 6 months. Article after article, every single day, another article comes out on this. And not a single one of them are good. Nobody is advocating for this. The other thing that I think is really scary in this world, and we've talked about this, and certainly we're having some conversations at the federal level, is what's the next generation of AI risk assessments? What's that gonna look like? You look at the Golden State Killer, I mean, they use genetics to identify the guy. Well, what if we use genetics to identify if somebody's a criminal? Well, you're related to a bunch of criminals. Like, all your relatives are in jail. All your friends are in jail. We use Facebook to see who your friends are and use that to determine. Because you know what? Probably a lot of that stuff's probably predictive. But that's where this is going. And to me, that's more scary than these stupid checkbox, you know, decision-making frameworks that we have. And I think that's probably...
They made a movie about that one. So
they did. They did.
Minority Report.
Yeah. Minority Report, yeah. That's where this is going. That's where this is going. So just to give you a couple examples, and I gave you the Maryland example, but you know, the shift to the risk-based system is blowing up. The MacArthur Safety and Justice Challenge sites that we've done open records requests on, we've got some startling results. Spokane County, Washington, risk-based system, 16.9% increase in pretrial incarceration in the first year. St. Louis County, Missouri, which is a little town you may have heard of called Ferguson, did a lot of reforms down there, which resulted in a 21.2% increase in pretrial incarceration in the first year. Charleston, South Carolina, spent $1.7 million to implement a new risk assessment process. Spent, I don't know how many man hours, I have a picture of their criminal justice coordinating council on my desk, because there's 150 of them on the council, so how much government time was spent? $1.7 million, all the government time, 1.6% increase in pretrial incarceration. Other things we're seeing, as I told you, lack of transparency, not only from the Arnold Foundation, but from others, including Compass, and in-house tools developed by governments who do not want to disclose how they put these things together. There's a lack of due process involved in this whole process because you may not realize this, but the Arnold Foundation actually has two algorithms. It has a scoring component, right? You're a 1 through 6. But it also has the DMF, which is called the decision-making framework, also known as a grid, right? Where we, in criminal justice, since 1970, we had this thing called the risk responsivity principle, which is what probation people use. They say, oh, the worse you get, the more we're gonna hammer you, and somehow that's gonna work. But that's the theory here, and that's how these decision-making frameworks are built. People went into a room and decided in Utah what this is gonna be. For example, what are the cut points? What's the risk tolerance we're gonna take in these cut points? Are we gonna say a 6, or risk, highest risk is gonna be a 75% failure rate, or we're gonna say it's gonna be a 20% failure rate? Those are substantive policy decisions made by people somewhere in a room over at the courts. Also, assigning what counts as a violent offense is done behind closed doors. There's no due process that leads to that. And I think for that reason, the Arnold Foundation decision-making framework is probably vulnerable to challenge under due process, which we're looking at. Obviously, we're calling for regulation of the risk assessment tools at the federal, state, and local levels. We're getting pretty close to having a hearing on the Courts and Constitution Subcommittee of the U.S. House Judiciary Committee. We'll put a major spotlight on this issue, and I think everybody around the country will be talking about it. As I said, I'll provide all these articles. The trade secret protection issue, I think, is a big one. And the name of the article is Life, Liberty, and Trade Secrets. Other issues that we've seen and that we're trying to do is forced revalidation and forcing local validation, because a lot of times people just take these tools off the shelf, use them, don't locally validate them. And then finally, you know, testing for racial bias. You know, you get 10 tools in Ohio, and somebody asked the question, well, is it racially biased? And the answer was, we don't know, because we never asked. We never asked when we were building it, and we haven't asked since 2009. And to me, that's a problem, because if these things are racially biased, one, they shouldn't be used, and two, that's probably the end of them, because nobody is gonna agree with them. So in the Buffen case, for example, the public defender in San Francisco said, they said these are race and gender neutral. Well, guess what? They're not. I think they're racist. Well, the problem is that's their reasonable alternative to bail, and so we'll have to see how that's gonna go. Regulatory issues, just to touch on a couple that we've seen. Obviously, we've had continuing conversations about licensure of bail recovery agents. We've had incident after incident, and you would think at some point we'll get something done. Unfortunately, there are some bail agents that were famous for a particular TV show that are stopping a lot of this, particularly in Idaho, killed the bill 3 years in a row. We ran it the first 2 years and said we're done, handed it over to the sheriffs, and of course, that bill was killed again this year. Colorado, we've been rejected several times, and like I said, Minnesota, we're gonna have to probably do something. I've talked about California Senate Bill 898, comparing us to auto insurance. There was a market conduct legislation passed in Colorado that limited fines for market conduct examinations to get rid of things where there was no consumer harm or where there were minor record-keeping issues. And that really stems from the market conduct round several years ago that I didn't really think was gonna happen again. But that issue largely was sort of fixed without the bill, because the problem was the department wouldn't approve forms for years, which we leaned on for, and they finally do that now. So these record-keeping problems have diminished. We've seen fights amongst property bondsmen and surety bondsmen in several states, which, yeah, you would never think that would happen. But particularly in Mississippi, it's been nasty. The Mississippi Insurance Commissioner is trying to raise the ratios in Mississippi. In North Carolina, property agents passed a bill to decrease the amount of ratio that they have to have, I think 12 to 1 to 8 to 1 or something like that. So there's been some activity on that level, but not much. And then the other thing that we've seen on the regulatory side is a trend of departments of insurance being politicized and used against the bail industry. To come out and, in advance of a bail reform, say, yeah, these guys are a bunch of jerks. And then to have a round of hearings around, like, New York that they're doing right now, where they just have town halls where people just come in and beat up the bail industry, and then they use that, publish reports. And so we've seen the commissioner in California recommend the elimination of bail, which I guess he's recommending the elimination of his staff as well, who would oversee the bail industry. But we've seen the politicization of departments of insurance on this issue, which, you know, I hadn't seen much of until this past year. So overall, just to kind of sum up, I'd say third generation of bail reform is truly a radial retread. It is a redo of the 1980s. It will similarly be shelved eventually. I think there'll always be fights over whether we should have pretrial, whether we should have bail, how much bail should be used, should it be cash, 10%. I think that'll go on forever probably. But the idea that we're gonna change state constitutions and go to the federal system, I don't think it's gonna happen. Largely because the federal risk-based system has increased pretrial incarceration from 24% in 1983 to 70% today. It's astounding. In fact, we did a hit piece on Joe Biden in Delaware because he was chair of the Judiciary Committee in 1989 when the U.S. Marshals came in and they said, or the chief judge came in and they said, well, how's this bail reform going for you? And they said, with all due respect, you've got to do something. We cannot handle the load. The pretrial population is exploding at a rate where we can't handle it. The examples given were the state of Delaware's inmates were being housed in New York, 278 miles away, because they couldn't handle it. And that has unfolded over this time period since 1984, and I think proves that the system doesn't work. Same thing's happening in New Jersey right now. Started off not detaining anybody until, oh, they get on a website called US Bail Reform, and they go, uh-oh, look at what's happening. We need to start locking more people up, so they did. And so the trend is going like this of locking people up. One jurisdiction's filing motions to detain in 88% of all cases, which is astounding to even think about. Statewide, they're filing detention motions in 44% of all cases right now, which is continuing to trend up. So what we're going to eventually see is the same thing, right? Bail is a difficult concept. As one professor said, no bail decision is perfect. There's always a risk that he's not going to show up, that he's going to commit another crime, or that he's innocent. So if I hammer him too hard, he might be innocent. It's never a perfect decision, but when you don't have bail, it's easier just to lock people up. It really is. Go to e-carceration, as I call it. There's massive pushback also, I'd say, against non-monetary conditions as an alternative to bail from a civil rights perspective. And that movement, I think, is gaining momentum as well. And as I said, in liberal states, that's the argument. Do you really, really want to trample people's liberties if a third party can post bail for them? Isn't that least restrictive if a third party can post bail? A lot of you may have seen the John Oliver piece a couple years ago where he attacked bail. A friend of mine called me and said, well, Jeff, I think you're done. I don't think we need bail anymore. We'll just get rid of bail. I said, okay, buddy. Let's give you a little bit of an example here. You live in Jefferson County, which at the time was kind of a big pretrial place. We've since turned it back around. But I said, well, you've got two prior DUIs, pal. So let's assume you get a third one. What do you think is going to happen to you when you get your third DUI? Well, I don't know. I'll just go home. Wrong move, dude. One, you're going to get a breathalyzer, which you're going to have to monitor your sobriety 3 times a day. Well, that's not fair. Let me finish. You're going to have to check in 3 times a week during the day while I'm working. That's not fair. Let me finish. And I went through all the different things he was going to have to do, and a GPS monitor, all the standard conditions for a third DUI. And finally he said, that's not fair, Jeff. And I said, well, yeah. Would you rather do that or pay the standard bail on a third DUI, which at the time was $5,000? He thought to himself, okay, I think you've got a point. And that's really what we're talking about is, looking at the whole basket of conditions and finding out, what works. So to conclude, I think what's going to happen over the next year is the algorithm issue is going to explode, not just in bail. It's going to explode in sentencing. It's going to explode in community corrections. It's going to explode in parole, probation. It's going to explode. And I think the idea that we can use a computer to eliminate the bail system is going to go away. And I think we're going to get back to where we've always been, which is, pretrial trying to take out bail, bail trying to take out pretrial. The whole conversation that we've been having, since this third generation of bail reform really started in my home state, unfortunately, in 2012. So that gives you a snapshot of where we are. And if you have any questions about any of this, feel free to contact me at any time. Definitely jump on our website, AmericanBailCoalition.org. Click in the news, and you can see all the different stuff we've been doing. Chris Blalock, I'm not sure if you're familiar with my colleague, who we hired. He's from New Jersey, lost his business. Decided to fight back, and we've been able to do some amazing, amazing stuff this year. I said I was going to wrap up, but let me just say one other thing. The way politics is done has changed because of the internet and computers, and so turning ourselves into basically a cyber warfare, like the ACLU does to us, is what we've been able to do. So we are able to go into a state with no lobbyist and reach every public official. We're able to get the public outraged and involved, talking to their legislators, talking about this issue. Obviously, the media footprint's been huge, and so we've been able to really tell our story, which is a good one to tell. And I'm not here because I make a lot of money and it's great. I actually do believe in bail, and the reason I'm in it is because I don't believe in incarceration, and if you're presumed innocent, you should be able to post bail and go home, period. And I don't believe in all this other bogus social engineering. A lot of people are going to commit crimes while on bail, but that's just the nature of the system that we have. So thank you for your time, and hopefully I didn't bore you too much. And like I said, feel free to contact me if you ever have any questions.
Anybody has any questions for Jeff?
Overall, how does Utah compare to everybody else in your mind?
First of all, the Department of Insurance has been always good to us. We have some nasty fights with.
Did you pay him to say that?
So, no, we really have had some nasty fights. Particularly, we're having major issues in Nevada right now with the Department of Insurance. We are beat fairly handily last session on some stuff, but I would say, one, the regulatory environment's good. Two, the agents are generally good. Three, you have bail recovery licensure here, which I think is good. So overall, I think your system is pretty good. I think on the due process and the criminal bail setting side, I think the system is also good. I think the cash-only bail thing needs to be clarified, which we've talked about, because it's unclear as to whether judges have that authority under the bill that passed last year or not, and so that's something that needs to be clarified. I will tell you, in Colorado, where defendants have a choice, the judges are still ignoring it and not making a finding on the record and just doing cash-only bail, you know, when they feel like it. So overall, I'd say Utah is a pretty good system. It's always great to come out here.
So. Well, thanks, Jeff, for informing us, because I know there's a whole lot of stuff that we didn't know about that you've given us, and some of the stuff that we did know about, your interpretation certainly helps, because on the outside, looking in on some of this stuff, it's pretty difficult to really digest and understand how to really look at it. And I also want to thank you for your efforts. I'm quite aware of all the things that you've done for our industry nationally, not just here in Utah, but thank you very much for your efforts, and
you got
keep
it.
Up the good fight. I think you do a good job.
So. Absolutely. Thanks.
Yeah. Thanks, okay. All right, we'll move on to old business. We've got an update on the PSA from Ken. All right, Ken, you're going to give us the update, huh?
Yeah.
I was thinking that Keisha and JC drew straws and some guy from the AOC got the short straw and had to come talk to us about the PSA. So
I talked with some of my people and seen how it's going. But they said that at first they very rarely got a change of bail recommendation from the judge, and the judge was just using the automated system to approve the PCs. My staff really likes that aspect, that they no longer have to call the judge and do it on the phone. They just go through usages. He said that over the last little while, there's been some changes, but they haven't seen a whole lot of OR releases, except for the most part. One of our people said there have been two that they've seen, two OR releases.
Did the PSA had recommended just to kick loose, and that's what ended up happening?
Yep.
Twice.
So I don't think it's a big deal, but I think kind of like what he said, that maybe the judge is just kind of working into it and doing business as usual. And they said that they've seen more often the judge has chosen to raise the bail above. When she has deviated from the bail, it's been a raise from the
in your
bail
facility,
schedule.
Is there a bail commissioner or anything like that in your facility that will set a bail based off of the uniform schedule when somebody's booked, or is the general procedure for them to be assessed by a judge to get their bail set?
So we use the standard bail, mm-hmm. and then the only time the judge deviates from that is at the time of the arrest, if the arresting officer makes her wear some aggravating circumstances. Mm-hmm. It's a phone call right there, and now since the PSA has come in, she's they said that's more common occurrence than the OR is for her to choose to deviate by raising the bail.
Now, in your facility, is it theoretically a person can be booked immediately, their bail would be set by a commissioner or an officer at the jail, that person bonds out before a judge even gets to see their PSA and all that sort of thing, that still exists?
Yep.
That's generally the procedure in most jurisdictions outside of Salt Lake. You know, I've often had a joke that you can leave the bar and get a DUI and still make last call in a lot of places because the process is pretty efficient. So, all right, well, thanks, Ken, for the update. I'm sure we do appreciate your insight on it, because I know you can provide us a view of things that we're never going to get on the outside. So we do appreciate you letting us know how it works on the inside.
They say that the change from manual to automated has affected the way they do their business day to day way more than the judge weighing in and changing the bail. They said that hasn't really been the case too much. They like the automation, that they're kind of indifferent about the judge weighing in and making changes to the bail. And really kind of treat it as a non-issue.
Good. I think
universally, we all think judges should get more information to make better decisions. It's just we're concerned that possibly the wrong decision will be made from our standpoint. So that's where that goes.
So.
Well,
I just have a question. Don't they have a full-time pretrial service in Park City now?
Kind of. We've got a couple deputies who are assigned to do supervision and stuff. And they started out with just a drug court, and then they took on some supervisory roles. But it's kind of a pilot project. Right now there's only the two deputies, so they couldn't supervise, you know, the justice and district courts. Caseload, they just couldn't.
Well, it used to be that Park City about paid my mortgage payment. Now it doesn't pay my bar bill. It's and I don't drink.
Better start.
I just was curious as to why we're not seeing the felony bail. We still see a lot of activity out of the Justice Court, out of Judge Sadler's court, on the misdemeanor stuff, but we see very little.
I'm surprised that Sadler's still sending you business. He's been retired for.
Well, not Sadler. what's her name?
Shauna Kerr.
Shauna.
Yeah. I don't know.
No timer. See, I remember that.
I do too. I remember him fondly. I don't know. Maybe people have reformed. That's it.
Clean up the rap, PC.
Yeah.
All right, well, thanks, Ken. Other business. We're going to elect a new chair and vice chair. I'm not sure how that procedure goes.
Basically, you just, there will be a nomination from one of the board. And
is this your first run or second run?
This is my first run.
I nominate Clay as chair again. If he wants to do it.
Okay, so then we'll need a vote from that.
All in favor of me being the new chair, or the staying as chair? In favor? Say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Okay.
Look at that. How about a vice chair?
How much longer is your tenure?
Don't know.
So
I'll nominate Dominic to be vice chair.
All right, we'll vote on Dominic as vice chair. All in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? Way to go, Dominic. We're really popular
right
here. All right, well, that's pretty much sums it up. Our next meeting will be in October.
I've just gone through the information from the last meeting's minutes. Was JC going to give us an update? She said she was going to give us an update on the public availability of data that they had put together.
I would assume, Kurt, that they don't have the data yet because it's been.
We just need to stay on top of it because it's easy to just forget about it.
Sure.
Okay. And if I may ask, Kathy. Who all gets the notifications of the meetings and the meeting docs that get emailed out? Is it just the board members?
I can feel that. So
you do that?
Yep. So board members, the people who get the documents are the board members and the staff, so basically us. The rest of the industry, I just send an agenda so that they can kind of attend to think about it.
Could you, I'd like to see the whoever else in the public or the industry also get a copy of the minutes from the past meeting.
Yeah, for sure. I can do that.
That's all I've got.
Steve, I'm not sure what may have happened this month, but I didn't get an agenda. I'm not trying to throw you under the bus.
Oh, really?
It could be some confusion with my email or something like that. But
he likes me.
If the next one doesn't come around, he might hear from me to try and make.
Oh yeah, perfect. After the meeting, why don't you clarify your email and put them in and make sure I got the right one.
I've got them in the past. This last one.
Okay.
All
All right, we'll adjourn the meeting. Motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
All in favor? Aye. All opposed? Okay, we're adjourned. Thanks, guys.